listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Is there an internet boogeyman? Do you think there really is? Should you be worried about your teenage daughter or son and the hours they spend texting and Twittering or posting photos on Instagram? But could it be possible that their online interactions could contribute to their becoming thoughtful and engaged citizens? Dana Boyd addresses questions like that and many others in her most recent and highly praised new book, It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens. And in explaining the networked realm of teens, Dr. Boyd uses a reporter's eye, a sociologist's insight, and the savvy of the Microsoft tech researcher, which she is. In a pretty fascinating bio on her website, Dana Boyd gives some background on her own unique intellectual trajectory. She attributes the fact that she made it through her Pennsylvania high school to three things. One, her unusually supportive mother. Two, the internet, which allowed her to connect with other smart kids, to ideas and to colleges. And three, to a misogynistic classmate who told her that girls can't do science, giving her the challenge to prove him wrong. I loved that. Dana Boyd is currently a research assistant professor in media, culture, and communication at NYU and a fellow at Harvard's Beekman Center, as well as a principal researcher for Microsoft. And tonight she'll be in conversation with Henry Jenkins, who is the provost professor of communication, journalism, and cinematic arts at USC. He's written and edited more than 15 books on media and popular culture, including Spreadable Media, Creating Meaning and Value in a Network Culture. And his most recent book, which he discussed last fall at Aloud, is titled Reading in a Participatory Culture, Remixing Moby Dick for the Literature Classroom. Dana and Henry have sparred and shared ideas with each other for some time, and I sat with them at dinner, and I think you will find it quite fascinating to listen in on their conversation. Please join me in welcoming Dana Boyd and Henry Jenkins.
So welcome to LA.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we'll plunge right into it. You write in the book's preface, the book is my attempt to describe the networked lives of teens to the people who worry about them. So what would you most want the worriers to know about the online lives of American teens?
I think a huge chunk of it is realizing that young people are reacting to the world that's around them, the world that we've constructed. And part of it is that we're projecting our anxieties onto these new technologies in the way that we've projected a whole set of anxieties onto old systems where young people could gather in public. And that part of the challenge is to step back and to appreciate what young people are doing in spite of what adults want them to be doing, and trying to see it through their own eyes. And so it's less about worrying and fretting and more about calming down and listening. And I think it's really imperative, considering that, you know, especially when we're talking about young people, we're trying to help them be a part of our society. And I think we do an odd thing, especially in an American context, where we espouse freedom as a core value of our, you know, our society, and yet we don't encourage young people to have freedom. And I think that conflict and that tension is something I keep seeing, you know, and I can't help but think, you know, I also opened the book with this, you know, young boy who, he was sitting there and he was showing me these videos he was making that he was putting up on YouTube, and it was at a time period when combining Mentos and Diet Coke was like the thing to do, and he was so excited. He had made his Mentos and Diet Coke videos, and they were viewed by a few people, and at one point he just looks at me and he's like, can you talk to my mom? Can you tell her that I'm okay? And it was just that moment where you're just like, oh. And you realize that, like, he was a normal kid. He wasn't really doing anything, but she didn't know how to read what he was doing online, so everything he did online was terrifying. And for him, he was just like, I'm just trying to figure out how my life works. And I was just like, of course. And that was a huge chunk of where I realized I had to speak much more publicly.
So is the message, what me worry, or are there things we should legitimately be worrying about?
I think there are a lot of things we should be legitimately worrying about, it, but we shouldn't be worrying about the top layer. I think this is where You know, I think about that moment where we see things for the first time and we blame the thing that allows us to see it, rather than actually getting to the undercurrents. And so I'll take up, a topic that, I deal with in the book, which is the issue of meanness and cruelty under the broader guise of things like bullying. And it's this odd moment because when I went in to look at, that ecosystem, I was convinced that things must be so much worse because of the internet. I mean, I'd heard the terrifying stories. I'd certainly seen cases that were just, mind-numbing and in the horror. And so I went in there, and I started diving into the literature first, and I started diving into experiences, and I realized something shocking. When you stabilize a definition of bullying, we haven't actually seen a rise in 30 years, which is actually really confusing. I was like, okay, well, it must be just worse when it happens online, but there's actually now large-scale national surveys done in different methodological approaches that consistently show that young people report that bullying is worse at school with greater emotional duress and more significant consequences. Okay, that's strange and confusing. And so I started talking to young people, trying to figure this out, and of course the parents were telling me, oh, well, it's because it extends the school day, right? It's worse because, what was happening in school continues on. And I was like, okay, that's a really reasonable approach. And so I started trying to understand this with regard to young people, and they were like, yeah, that's true, but so does the support system. So does the way in which I can be loved and valued by my friends. And, this dynamic, I was like, okay, that's fascinating. And then I started trying to figure out where things had changed, right? What made sense? And I ran into one particular set of things that just blew my mind and showed the sort of complexity of it, which emerged when the media was really talking about the horribleness of question and answer services. You might have heard of FormSpring or Ask.fm. These are often identified as these terrible sites. And I was really sort of fascinated by them because the way they work is that people can anonymously ask a question. But that question is sent to the recipient, but only when the recipient responds to it is it made visible. And so I was scratching my head. I was like, why would young people respond to these horrible questions, right? What's the motivating factor? Because this was always seen and mediated. The media was discussing it as a form of bullying. And so I went and called up the companies, and I'm like, can you help me figure this out? And they dove in, and they came back to me with a really scary thing, because I gave them a bunch of cases to look into. And they said, it's often the same IP address that's asking the horrible question as is answering it. Now, what that means technically is that, and it was often within 20 minutes. In other words, it was the same person anonymously asking themselves a horrible question and responding to it. And that's, what? And so I talked to a researcher named Elizabeth Englander, and we said, can we look at this more holistically? And she found that indeed 1/3 of young people admitted to self-bullying online, which was just shocking to me, right? I was like, and I talked to young people and I talked about how important it is to look tough, to look like you can handle anything, and I dive into more complexities within the book, but the reason I point this out is that we look at the things we see. We see the visibility, we see the meanness and cruelty. We blame the technology, and indeed there are specific cases for which it is a totally different game. More often than not, the media calls it bullying when we should be talking about it as criminal harassment, but that's a separate matter. But we look at the visibility and we blame the technology rather than diving deep and seeing what's more holistically going on.
So let's do a little flashback. We heard in the introduction the internet was a really important part of your growing up. Yeah. I have to say that I'm in a generation, my first undergraduate job was filing punch cards for a mainframe computer. So we have very different histories with this technology. But take us on that, how we get from you in high school, as you were hearing described in the introduction, to the researcher you are today, focusing on contemporary young people.
Yeah, I mean, so it all started with my brother, who I adore to pieces, and he had gotten a hold of a computer because he had had various vision issues, and the doctors deemed that this was a good technology to help him get eye-hand coordination. I'm not quite sure how that all worked out, but regardless, he managed to get a computer. And at some point, when I was in middle school, he hooked it up to the phone line, which is the worst thing you can do to a teenage girl, right? So the one phone line was making terrible sounds, and I was like, I'm waiting for the call, right? Whatever the call was that never came, I was waiting for it. And so I remember marching up to his room at one point and just like being all upset with him. And I'm like, what are you spending so much time doing with this computer? And he, of course, it was a modem, and he was showing me that there was this whole world. It was a world of Usenet, now an archaic technology. And I fell in love. And I fell in love with this opportunity to interact with people. And part of it was that this was an era before we were in many ways afraid of technology. In fact, anybody using a computer was clearly doing something educational. Which, you know, considering most of my friends were hackers and there were a lot of police involved, I'm not sure that that was the right assessment to make making about that set of decisions. But I had this great opportunity to talk to strangers who radically shaped my life. I'll never forget two conversations in particular. One was with, at the time I intended to go into the military, and it was with a young man who was serving in the first Gulf War, and it was talking me through what it was like to be sort of on the ground in this war, and helping me see a geopolitical context that was so foreign to what I was reading in the local paper. And it was just really mind-blowing. And the other really critical conversation was with a transgender woman who allowed me to ask all sorts of inappropriate questions as I was trying to work out gender and sexuality. And so I, you know, these moments were so amazing to me. And I went to study computer science. And then I thought that I would build the systems. But I kept asking peculiar questions about the people who used them. And in fact, it was you, Henry, who, when I started grad school take one, first encouraged me to go back and look at what had changed since I was a teenager online. And under Henry's guidance, I went back and looked at a lot of the queer dynamics that had shifted from my youth, who we all came out online, it was a relatively safe space, to an environment where that was no longer true by 99-2000. And you know, from that point on, I just kept asking more and more questions, and ended up working with an anthropologist who sort of retrained me from those computer science ways. And she took me under her wing and helped me figure out how to be more methodical in my approaches. And I just kept falling in love with trying to understand it. And somehow it never stopped.
And you got involved with social networks before anyone else, online before anyone else, was looking at that stuff.
Yeah, well, I was, you know, I was an early adopter of technologies that I didn't know you could be an early adopter of. I, you know, in 1997, decided I was working with a Buddhist professor, a monk, and he was asking me to do a lot of self-reflection. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to do self-reflection. He was like, write it down. And I'm like, you mean pen? I don't use a pen. So I was like, oh, I'm going to type it up. And if I'm going to type it up, I might as well put it on the internet, because clearly that's logical. So I put all of these reflections up. And if you're going to put them up and you're going to post a new one all the time, I put a forward and backward button, think GeoCities days. And if you're going to have a lot of them, you might as well make a calendar. And all of a sudden, I had a blog in 1997, and I didn't even know it was a blog until 2003. And so that was kind of funny. And the same thing ended up happening with social network sites, which is that it was 2001, and I got this bright idea that it would be really, this was also at MIT, that it would be really interesting to scrape people's email metadata. And determine how much you knew about other people's social relationships just by looking at your inbox. You know, sort of relevant to today. And so I did this huge network analysis and put it up as an art exhibit in New York City, pretty much relying on the fact that nobody who had showed up to the art exhibit was more than 2 degrees away from me. Fair assessment. So you could walk in and you could type your name into the system and it would show a network graph of all the people you knew. It was a good way of scaring people about all things privacy related. And you know, I had a fabulous time building this out. And so this was, you know, December of 2002, I received a phone call from somebody who had seen that exhibit being like, there's this new site called Friendster. You might find it interesting. I was like, okay. So I started going to the site. Just to give you context, the first news article written about Friendster was June of 2003. So it was, you know, 6 months ahead of that. And I just started writing about it to my audience of four. All of a sudden, people were paying attention to it, and my audience changed. And I ended up being the person who was tracking the cultural practices. And part of it was that the cultural practices of early social network sites were the cultural practices of most early social technologies defined by self-identified geeks, freaks, and queers. And I was all three, so it was perfect.
So about the time you were my student, we were running programs at MIT on race, gender, and cyberspace. And I remember putting up a poster at the time that said, in cyberspace, no one knows your race unless you tell them. Do you tell? And we thought we were being so provocative. But clearly, something fundamentally has changed about how we perform identity online. And we're seeing that, in fact, cyberspace is probably no less segregated than the social spaces we face in our everyday lives. And you have certainly been one of the people who really mm-hmm. called attention to the gated community qualities of online social networks.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, more often than not, the internet can tell you your race when you didn't even know it, which is also really intriguing in the metadata world. It was 2007, and I had just been in the field with teenagers watching them go back and forth between whether MySpace or Facebook was the site. And I was, intrigued by this conversation. I was like, oh, that's fascinating. People talk about how this was choice. And it was like, classic market logic, right? It's all about choice. I was like, okay. Until I met this woman in Massachusetts, this teenager who looks at me and she's, really uncomfortable and kind of sitting there, doesn't want to talk to me. And she looks up at me at one point and she's like, I don't really mean to be racist, but MySpace is kind of ghetto. And I was like, whoa, what do you mean by that? And all of a sudden I got her to sit and illustrate the way in which her peers understood these two sites in light of the broader race and class dynamics of this country that she didn't even have the language to express, right? But she had mapped it out and she understood it. And I realized that this was something I had seen regularly. In fact, one of the first sort of experiments I did on MySpace, when I was living here in LA, I spent a lot of time at a particular school in town that I'll leave unnamed. And one of the things about the school is that they were very proudly talking about how they had a very diverse population that was, all integrated within their communities. And I was like, really now? That's not what I'm seeing. And so I ended up scraping all of that school's MySpace, it was MySpace era profiles. And indeed, even though these classes were supposedly mixed, the Facebook networks were not, right? The MySpace networks were not. It was very much shaped by, particularly the racialized dynamics. And that even when people would connect across race lines, they weren't commenting on each other's pages, they weren't engaging. And so I'd seen this, and I'd watched this, and I did this very funny thing, which is that I blogged about it, right? I was like, oh, this is fascinating. I'll sort of document this, this Facebook-MySpace tension. And then I went to bed, which one should not do when one writes a provocative essay. And I woke up the next morning, and the BBC had covered it as a formal report from Berkeley. And I had an onslaught of 10,000 messages screaming at me. And it reminds me, I wear a note that says, never read the comments, right? Which is something I should have learned back then, but now I have it on there all the time to tell me. I had threats from both MySpace lawyers and Facebook lawyers because apparently I was demeaning both of them, which is also intriguing. But I had all of these teenagers who were like, you're right, but you're missing this part. And they fleshed out what was going on. And I thought it was really intriguing because the cultural ramifications are so significant. So it wasn't just about how people had defined their networks, how they reproduced the structural systems. It was the way in which these larger systems were building on top of that. So the military was allowing people to get on Facebook, as in the officers, but not allowing the soldiers to get on MySpace. College admissions officers were recruiting on Facebook, but not on MySpace. You had all of these layers. And, people always tell me, oh, well, that was just that time. That was the Facebook, MySpace thing. It's over. The same thing's happening again with regard to Vine and Instagram. It's just not often acknowledged, right? All the media talks about Instagram as this amazing thing. It's what young people are using everywhere. It's true. It's what privileged young people are using. And when you look at the demographics of Vine, which are extraordinarily popular, go unnoticed by the media, it's because most of it is low-income populations and Black and Latino youth. And so I look at these moments and how we reproduce this across segmentations, across networks, and we go unaccounting for it because it's just market choice.
But this connects to something we were talking about at dinner, the way to which the structure of high school is making it even harder for low-income and minority youth than it was when you were in school.
Yeah, it's one of those things that makes me really depressed. Like, I definitely drank a certain Kool-Aid in the 90s that was like, the internet, it would connect people, it would bridge all conversations, we can see other people, it'd be awesome. And indeed, you've written some amazing things about these moments of connection that are so powerful. But what's challenging for me is the way in which it reproduces social divisions, and it does so under the guise of personalization. This is what you want, right? And I'm witnessing this full force right now in my, you know, even in my personal life, which is that my partner's Israeli. And as you probably noticed, there's a few things happening in Israel right now. And he's got a large connection of Palestinian friends as well, who, you know, and his friends in Israel primarily write in Hebrew, some English. His friends that are Palestinian write in a mix of Arabic and English. And he has found that Facebook at this point shows him all of the Israeli and none of the Palestinian, right? And this is somebody who's chosen to make these connections, right? Reinforcing something because he never writes out in Arabic, he only writes out in Hebrew. And it becomes this interesting dynamic of what do we get to see? And, you know, we saw this with the Twitter dynamic. You know, Twitter had a trending topics development at one point, and the idea was to show what was being discussed in public. And I'll never forget shortly after its launch was the night of the Black Entertainment Television Award show. And all of the Twitter trending topics were names, people that are primarily artists who were just icons of the Black community. And the amount of racist commentary that followed this of like, oh, look who Twitter's celebrating, and that's a nice way of putting it. And it just devolved, and it's this reminder that even these tools that can connect us don't do so automatically, right? We have to purposefully and intentionally build those connections. I mean, I think this has been something that's been core to your work, is how to really build those connections. Because I see on the ground, it doesn't just happen naturally. And I mean, your thoughts on like how you actually build it.
I think since both of us have MIT somewhere in our biographies, there's a tendency to see us as technological determinists or technological celebrators. And in fact, both of us, I think, start from a social or cultural base and attempt to understand what the social causes of things are. Why, you know, for me, it's about participatory culture. What happens if after struggles over 100, 200 years of people to get access to the means of cultural production and circulation, we expand it? Not to the point that everyone has access, but to more people had access than ever before. What's a transition a society is going to go through? How do we support that participation? How do we support diversity within that participation? All of those are key questions that don't start with the technology. But understanding how people live with technology is a crucial piece of that.
But I think the other thing that becomes really imperative in this is thinking about the values that we espouse and build into these technologies holistically, not even just at a designer or developer sense, but the things we normalize within our own usage, our own everydayness. You know, these tools are built and their early adopters are almost always American, right? And there are certain things that are deeply American that we don't even account for about how this affects different kinds of global conversations. One of my current obsessions right now is how we even constitute fairness. And fairness is actually a really fraught concept in an American society. Historically, we've battled it as an issue of equality versus equity, right? Equality being the dominant paradigm of American, you know, the American dream, which is that, you know, level playing field, meritocracy, you know, equal opportunity, and everybody shows up and all is good. And of course, equity says it doesn't, not so simple, right? There's a long history of all sorts of marginalization that we need to account for, and you know, whether we talk about you know the recent conversations about reparations that emerged in the Atlantic, or whether we talk about the history of affirmative action, you know, this conversation about equity is really an important one. Of course, in the broader American consciousness, we've labeled it either communism or socialism, depending on our political state. But there's a third logic that comes with how these technologies that are built and as they fit into the capitalist system that I think really shapes a lot of this that we don't account for. And I kind of think of it as a market-driven logic, right? Think about it in a business sense, right? If you fly more than I do, you know, Delta wants to keep you as a customer, so you get you don't have to pay the $25 fee for your baggage, you get the better seats, you get the free food, right? All of that kind of goodness. And we deem that to be fair in a business sense. But what happens when that same logic is how we allocate resources within a community? Let's just start with law enforcement, right? So when we think about how we allocate law enforcement amongst that model, we think about these communities that are, historically higher levels of crime. So for example, you think about Chicago's predictive policing mechanisms, and there's certainly some instantiation of it here. But of course, what's not accounted for is that law enforcement officers need to clear warrants and are measured on certain arrest records. So then you place them in a certain place, and guess what happens? The reason I point this out is that these technologies come into and are shaped by these social values that in some ways we can't even have a civil conversation as a country about what those are or how they play out. And I worry about that because then we export them without thinking through how that might work out or not work out. I think I grapple with it, as we see this, because we see these young people that you spend a lot of time with resisting or trying to challenge those norms and the ways in which they're pushed back against so heavily by, adult society. And it saddens me because I don't think it's coming from malintention. I think it's coming from a failure to actually have a meaningful conversation about the society we're constructing.
So I think we established a long time ago that my research methods leads me to look at exceptional cases of innovation, experimentation, creativity. And so I end up being labeled an optimist, and your methodology ends up having you look at the normative, the average, the typical, where your vantage point is a little more pessimistic.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think of it as cleanly pessimistic. I think, I often... Compared to you, I get labeled as such.
Yes. And then, compared to me, almost everyone on the planet gets labeled as such.
I think for me, I start from, a very much a theory of power. And part of it is just trying to appreciate where people come in relationship to it. And, a lot of the book, which people do label as very optimistic, is about recognizing and taking seriously those who are even in really marginalized situations and how they're responding to the structural conditions around them. And you see truly innovative coping mechanisms, some of which highlight the conflicts within our society. And so I want to highlight those moments of just trying to take control in the environment. My pessimism stems from a broader concern and critique about the society that we've collectively constructed and continue to, I would argue, deconstruct. When I get really mopey, which doesn't take a lot these days, I'm convinced that the United States is a dying empire, and the question is whether or not we're going out pleasantly or not, and that never goes over particularly well. Part of it is a lot of it comes from these battles, right? These moments of like how we've made decisions amongst a youth population who is not necessarily going to be better off collectively than their elders. And I really struggle with that because locally, I think a lot of young people are coping just fine or, as well as previous generations. But holistically is where a lot of my concerns really come from. And, today's recent news just doesn't really tend to make me celebrate the state of our society. And I struggle with that.
So you use the example of the Los Angeles high school students walking out in support of immigration reform to illustrate some of the ways that social networking sites may be enabling forms of coordinated political activity, but also the ways that young people's political actions get trivialized or patronized.
Yeah.
So given our current setting, I wondered if you could say more about what lessons we might take from that for thinking about the current moment for the political lives of young people.
Yeah. So the context of this was there was a bill, H.R. 4437, scary that I know the bill number, I can't even remember its name now, which was basically an immigration reform that was happening in the mid-2000s. It was sparking a lot of these conversations. There was a lot of political mobilization in a classic sense from traditional civil rights leaders. So it meant a lot of Spanish-speaking radio was organizing and mobilizing a lot of older populations to engage in various protest activities, including a very big march here in Los Angeles. And a lot of of young people that I had met, especially some who would become dreamers at that point, that was not really the label, were wanting to take a stand themselves. And they felt as though their voices and their stories as youth were not being heard amongst this broader adult conversation, both because some of them were undocumented and been there for their entire lives, but also because there were many documented young people of undocumented parents who felt they had a different story. So they started mobilizing, and at that time, MySpace was the thing, and they rallied so many people on MySpace, being like, hey, we can turn out, and the idea was to walk out of school at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning in order to make a stand, a very youth-centric stand. And they did, very successfully. They ended up taking over the highways. They ended up walking out en masse. The numbers were huge here and in Nevada, like California, notably Los Angeles, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and the largest center of it was here in town. And the response from the media was just outright, dismissive. They managed to find the young people who didn't really understand what was going on, so they got them all over the place being like, I don't know, I just wanted to skip school, even though so much of it was deeply political, and that even as young people didn't always have a sense of the larger landscape, they knew what they were doing. Mayor Villaraigosa responded to this in this really shaming fashion. He basically came up and said, Cesar Chavez would be ashamed of you. How dare you? Your parents came to this country to give you an education, and look what you do with it. Now, of course, LAUSD was fined $100 per student per day by the state for the kids who skipped school. So there were, some economic considerations in all of this. But the outright panning of these young people's mobilization, their efforts to actually take a stand, to use the technologies to make their voices heard, was just deeply disheartening. And, luckily, as your work has shown phenomenally, that did not stop the dreamers. But it was just this moment of, like, how often young people actually take these steps to be civically engaged, to try to get through with the tools and the structural environments that they know, and how often we dismiss it because that's not the right kind of activism.
So I can pick up the story a little bit, that my team at USC has now interviewed about 200 young activists for a book that I'm finishing up this summer called By Any Media Necessary, which is really looking how young people are conducting their political lives online, and the Dreamers are a central case study there. And so what we're finding with the young dreamers, the young undocumented youth who are seeking citizenship right and education right, is they're very effectively using YouTube as a platform, or Vimeo as a platform, to record straight to camera confessional videos, which begin simply with my name is Jose, or my name's Mohammed, or my name is whatever, and I am undocumented, and telling their story in a really powerful way. And then the first order, this was important because many of them didn't know each other, that they were living in hiding, and they're finding each other. We required social media participatory culture practices. But secondly, they discovered that many Americans didn't know anyone who they knew was undocumented. They probably did know someone who was undocumented, but they weren't aware of the fact. And so hearing these stories in youth voices about what happened when their scholarship was taken away because they were undocumented, about why they couldn't travel to a Harry Potter convention because they didn't have the papers that would allow them to get on an airplane, that has been key in shifting public opinion around the Dreamer cause, and has really helped increase the visibility. And that they've been able to attach themselves to stories in the culture, for example, the Superman story, right? If ever there was an illegal alien in the United States, it's Kal-El from the planet Krypton, who slipped across the border in the middle of the night, got adopted by an Anglo family, has been hiding his true identity ever since, but has nevertheless been able to fight for truth, justice, and the American way. And so taking the iconography of the superhero and reproducing that as a popular way into their experience, they've been very effective. But they also, contrary to someone like Malcolm Gladwell, who's talking about people not taking risk, they're going into immigration headquarters, turning themselves over as undocumented, and recording the process and transmitting it out to the world. In a way, it's as if you were facing the fire dogs and had a camera strapped to your shoulder. And these young people are incredibly courageous here in LA, across the country, and demonstrate some of the political potentials of these technologies. But it's not about a single medium, right? Which is why the technological version, the Twitter revolution argument, doesn't really hold. Our argument is they're used making political change by any media necessary, but the tools of social media, video sharing, are playing a crucial role in that process.
But they're also coming back to a practice that in some ways they youth had been demeaned in doing, which is that they're actively networking and connecting and building community. And part of it is this is in response to, you know, a really an 8-10 year time period in which we've told young people that all strangers are dangerous and only out to hurt you and harm you. And I think that what's so powerful about the participatory culture that Henry studies is, and the Dreamers in particular, is this reminder of just how important it is to connect to people who share your experiences. And it finds this moment of validation and value and connection that can be so powerful. And I think about this in light of how much effort has been put into telling young people that everybody out there is evil. And I worry about it. And this is where, you know, I do hope that the participatory culture that you've mapped starts to expand a lot more. And I think it really behooves all of us to resist that culture of fear in order to encourage it. Because the case that Henry's talking about very specifically here, so much good comes from that moment of realizing you're not alone. And of course, the parallels with the queer community are just, you know, astronomical here.
Yeah, they're talking about coming out has become a central metaphor. So many of the tactics of the Dreamers come from the queer rights movement. Yeah. And that's a really important. So one of the things that happens online is movements learn from each other because things are a little more transparent. Practices move rapidly in shared spaces from one
Absolutely.
Group to another. And the Dreamers is a really spectacular example of that.
Yeah, and that shift of awareness and knowledge, part of it is the blessing and curse of the speed of all things on the internet, right? Which is we often, you know, be like, it's too fast, it's too whatnot. But that porousness becomes so valuable, and not just even at a local sense, but at a global sense. And I think part of it is when you stop and are willing to pay attention. And I guess part of what I'm hoping for is that, you know, the case studies of these, you know, these exceptional young people or these really creative minds, how do we start and respect and recognize those practices more generally? How do we encourage our own young people to actually reach beyond their own home communities and appreciate what's happening? And how do we resist the tendency to just build more gated communities, you know, in physical space or online? Because it's, you know, now more than ever, we desperately need people to learn and appreciate from those who have different values. And I'll say this, one of the things that's been heartbreaking in this is that we haven't taken seriously the social engineering projects that exist in this country or used to exist. And I think about two in particular. U.S. Armed Services and the elite universities in this country have both really actively helped connect people to difference in a way that's actually been really productive. And I'll give it the example more specifically with elite education, because it's often more familiar to a room like this. But you know, those college roommates that you or your children had were not actually random, right? They're very much intended to help you connect across lines to see different worlds. And what's difficult about this is that social media has been used by a lot of young people to find out who their roommate is, to figure out that they're nothing like them, and to ask for a change of roommate before they even show up on campus, because they've already determined that they don't like this person. And that's actually really terrifying, because we have purposely socialized young people into telling them that difference is bad in ways that actually have costs to our social fabric. And that's one of the reasons that these cases that we look at of people who are isolated and alone finding connection are so powerful. The question is, how do we make that the way of approaching all forms of social interaction? How do we make diversity a desirable outcome rather than this thing that you sort of push up against unless when it's, you know, cleanly given to you on a platter?
So we've both been sharp critics of the digital native, digital immigrant distinction. And you write in the book, I believe the digital native rhetoric is worse than inaccurate, it's dangerous. So I see some connections between what we're talking about now and that rhetoric, the idea of leaving people alone and they will naturally be feral children of the internet and find their way to the most constructive behavior online is a very dangerous idea.
Right, and I think it also undermines our own role in all of this, which is to say that, you know, when we position young people as digital natives, we assume that their understandings of technology will just come from above, right? Somewhere up there, you know, they're born into a generation and they'll just know. And we don't take into account all of the kinds of learning, formal and informal, that actually really shape young people's understandings and experiences of network technologies, shape it differentially, which is to say that more privileged populations who have greater levels of access, and this goes to the participation gap that Henry talks about extensively, what they expose to or what they understand is so much greater than those who have limited levels of access or opportunity to engage. But it goes beyond that. It's also that if you have a network of people who understand technically, are more sophisticated technically, they shape your understanding of these things, and if you're, not a part of those networks, you are also affected in those ways. Again, just think about something as simple as Facebook, right? What you're exposed to, what information is shared with you. And so we've created this environment where it's just like, oh, young people will figure it out, they're smarter than all of us, and we don't take responsibility either as parents or as educators or as a broader community for how important it is to help people, engage with this critically. And in the chapter, I actually, I talk about attention that emerged throughout the 2000s has died down to a certain degree now, which I'm grateful for, which is the Wikipedia is bad, anybody can edit it, how dare you, therefore never use it. And I would interview young people and be like, okay, I hear this, Wikipedia is bad, so you don't use it, except you do, but you won't admit it. And then I'd say, well, what do you use? So, well, we were told Google was good. And I was like, really? And I'm like, why is Google good? And they're like, well, they say what the right answers are. And I'm like, how does that work? And they're like, well, they make certain that it's the right answers. But, and I realized that their mental models of this was that somebody was choosing the results of every search query. And I was like, oh, that's not good. And that is one moment of not understanding the kinds of decision-making that happens within this environment. But it becomes really critical when you think about all of the algorithmic decision making that is increasingly happening, right? For those who use Facebook who don't realize it, you don't see most of the content posted by your friends, right? On average, you're seeing about 20 to 40% of it, right? And it's a set of decisions curatorially about what happens. Do you even realize that? Do you realize how these systems shape what you see or what you don't see? How do you make decisions in light of this? This is all part of that broader technical literacy. And so whether or not somebody can actually figure out how to get on the site doesn't matter. How they're experiencing it, what they're exposed to, there's so many layers to this that it becomes really critical to own it and make sense of it and to not just assume that the next generation will figure it out. And I worry because we keep passing the buck on this one rather than, getting to the heart and soul of why media, critical media literacies are so critical. And that, of course, Henry has been one of the, biggest pioneers and voices on how important these issues are. And I bow down to him on all of this because I think, he's been fighting this fight for how long? Never mind, I shouldn't ask those questions. For a very long time.
As long as I can remember.
And I think that, it's becoming more and more critical, and I think that we're using the natives' rhetoric to take less and less responsibility, and that worries me.
Yeah, and the other flip side of it is calling yourself a digital immigrant. Both native and immigrant are problematic terms already, let's be clear, but it also implies that you can't learn, that the ways it's been constructed, that it allows adults off the hook. Whereas I think the most powerful places of learning are places where young people and adults are learning with each other without the hierarchies of schools or families or churches. And those are the very spaces that stranger danger sort of rhetoric pathologizes. It cuts you off from the experience you were describing, where you got to know a transsexual online and had a frank discussion that was really crucial for you.
Yeah. No, and I think that, moral panics around strangers are cyclical. We are currently in a lull, and I'm sort of bracing myself for the next round of it because it'll come back full force. And I worry about it because I think that the last thing we should be doing as we live in an interconnected society is encouraging people to be afraid of others. I think a lot more of it is how to appreciate difference, how to understand and assess risk, rather than creating these black or white narratives. And I think it also behooves all of us, right, to really account for what the decisions we make are of who we're allowing ourselves to be exposed to or not, both online and offline, right? We make these decisions in our lives where we purposefully come and go into safer and easier spaces. I think of as a scholar, Banaji, and she's done this great work on workplaces and workplace diversity. And of course, we know the stats that, you know, more diverse teams are more successful. But what her work has shown pretty phenomenally is that those on more diverse teams believe themselves to underperform those on homogenous teams. They think it's a much more miserable experience than those on homogenous teams. And so part of it is this moment of saying, you know, not just these rhetorics of ownership or whatnot, but how do we purposely go out of our way to be uncomfortable? Because that is really a critical part of this as well. It's not just about the technical skills, it's about the willingness to realize that we live in an interconnected society, and it's about the ways that technology makes that possible, but it's also about the ways we own that. All of that comes together in really important ways. And I, whether you want to talk about how the Russian media is covering what's going on in Ukraine, or whether you want to talk about the Middle East politics, it's not even just a matter of, what's happening in this country. It becomes a global, necessity. And it's something that I think that we are eschewing in part because we allow for this, the technology, it just automatically does good. And it's like, it doesn't work like that.
So I'm going to ask Dana one more question, and then we're going to open it up for the floor for questions. So if you're thinking or queuing up for some questions shortly. But let's continue on this line and think about the role of parents in all of this, right? I've used the line, we don't need parents snooping over kids' shoulders. We need them watching their back. In other words, issues of privacy and surveillance in the family are a crucial part of what's problematic about our current relationships around new technology. So what role should parents be playing in the online lives of teens?
Yeah, it's such a good and important question. And I think a lot about this amazing work by an urban theorist by the name of Jane Jacobs, Canadian, who's just done phenomenal work. And she looked really closely at the issue of safety. What makes a community safe? And it's not more law enforcement officers, right? It's actually the practice of eyes on the street, a willingness as a community to look out and make certain things are okay. And what that means is that when, the kids are out there tousling one another and making a mess of things, you leave them alone. But when somebody falls off their bike and gets hurt, everybody rushes out and makes sure that they're okay, right? It's that collective sensibility that you're part of something and, figuring out the balances. And we have moved to such a heightened level of individualism that, parents are responsible for their own children, and that, not only should you not be paying attention to other children, but you darn if anybody else is paying attention to your child. And it becomes this hugely isolating dynamic. And so we create this situation that's really unhealthy for both young people and parents, right? Parents are all of a sudden responsible for a dynamic that is so far beyond what they can do as parents. Kids, they don't always like their parents. Right? There are always times where you're just like, Mom. So having this one, person you can turn to becomes deeply frustrating. Even when you really love your parents, even when there's a healthy relationship. And so, what I've often encouraged parents to do is, a couple of different things. Obviously, communication is a really critical part. You got to think about the values in your home and all of this. But there's a couple of things that you can do that are very important. One is make certain that, your child has a lot of other adults that they can turn to. People that you trust, but that doesn't mean people who will tell you everything, right? The cool aunts and uncles and coaches and cousins and that whole support network. And that means that, they're not going to rat your kid out when, he's cursing. But when something serious is going on, it's going to figure out a delicate way of working with you to figure it out. This becomes important also during crises, right? Whether we're talking about divorce, whether we're talking about death, whether we're talking about a variety of other things that happen. The second key thing as parents is, pay less attention to your child than you're paying to the other kids in your community. And this is often against all of our senses and comfort levels. Because what your child's health and well-being is very much shaped by his or her community writ large. And what that means is that, you know, if those in his or her community are not doing well, it's really going to affect your child. And if you're really engaged and caring, especially if you're the cool parent within the community, you darn well better be there for the other kids in their community. Again, especially during moments of crisis, right? And that becomes a really important thing. The other thing is, give your kids space. Let them explore and experiment. Your goal is to help them transition to adulthood. And that means bumps and bruises, right? And that's par for the course. And of course, you want bumps and bruises and not broken bones. And it's finding that balance that becomes really critical. And realizing that the worst thing you can do is allow your 18-year-old to show up on either one of our campuses ill-prepared to actually navigate other people or other contexts. That doesn't go over well, right? And I will say, we're struck by, you know, the onslaught of young people who this is their first experiment with or experience with freedom. And it's like, oh, things do not go well here. So it's, you know, how do you actually help young people find more freedom, figure out how to take responsibility, and go through that transition? There's no magical age. There's no magical formula. It's a negotiation with your child. But it's about taking seriously the interaction rather than the set of formalistic mechanisms of how to be a good parent. And I hate to say it, it's hard, right? There's nothing easy about parenting, and most of you know that, you know, full force. But it becomes, you know, this weird moment with technology where all of a sudden we want to blame the technology, we want to focus on the technology. Technology is either the savior or the demon. And that does young people a serious disservice. And that's one of the reasons why, just because you have the tools where you can snoop, doesn't mean you should, because you often undermine the most important aspect of your relationship with your child, which is trust. And this is where I come back to the teens that I met who will literally turn to me and be like, what did I do that's so bad? Why does my mom not trust me? And you're like, oh, that's terrible. Because you know that that's not what the parent intends. But indeed, that's often how these things get read. Because no matter what you think about looking at content, surveillance is an exertion of power, right? Plain and simple. And it's read as such even when you don't intend it as such. And so finding a way of navigating that and not exerting power over when you don't mean to be doing that is really important.
So yeah, if you wouldn't stalk your daughter at the mall or your son on a date, you probably shouldn't be reading their social networking sites to see how they're interacting with their friends. But what you should have, I think, is a clear dialogue with them about the things that matter in their lives. And you should be attentive to
Absolutely.
Their online lives as part of the overall experience that's shaping who they are and part of the challenges they face. Harvard researchers are telling us that that very small number of kids have any kind of mentorship relationship with an adult about their online lives, right? No, that there's no adult they can turn to for the social complexities they're encountering online. And so they desperately do need someone who's watching their back. What they don't need is someone snooping over their shoulders.
I also think about how important it is to learn to ask non-judgmental questions. And I say this because there are things that your kids know or understand better than you do. And, you know, back in my day when we walked uphill, you know, both ways, just never cuts it in this kind of dynamic. And I think a lot about this beautiful book by an anthropologist named Jean Briggs, who talks about how Inuit kids learn morality, right? And it's very different than an American sensibility. Because Inuit kids are asked questions of all the time, questions that would make an American sort of just, you know, get all uncomfortable. And my, you know, a good example that comes out in this book is, you know, your son at a young age comes up to you and is like, you know, mommy, 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 I hate Bobby. Bobby's mean, right? The American response would be, it's okay, honey, I love you, right? That's the classic American response. The Inuit response would be, well, why don't you kill him? Right? You can just imagine, don't try this on the playground, right? This is not a good idea. And the response from your child, assuming that he's not a sociopath, would be, I don't hate him that much. Well, how much do you hate him? Well, I just don't like what he did, so what do you want to do about it? And it becomes this way of letting them work through what the decisions are. And what I struggle with is that when I watch parents interact with kids around a lot of technology, they ask questions of like, well, why'd you post that, right? And it's this automatic judgment, just rather than curiosity. And of course, that's part of the challenge of, you know, parent-child relationships. And I think back of, one of those moments in my time, my life that, where question really shifted my perspective on the world. I, at the age of 18, shaved my head. I was very proud of how this would make my mom respond, and she responded right on cue. Oh my gosh, this is terrible. What are you trying to do to, you know, you were such a beautiful girl, blah, you know, it was great. And I was like, ha, 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 ha. And my grandmother comes in, and she looks at me and goes, huh, why do you want to look like you were in the Holocaust? And walks off. Right. Oh, whoa, right, that was not the intention here. But that question said in this just like, huh, that's fascinating way was so, you know, thought-provoking for me. And when I look at young people and a lot of their technology uses, some of their best mentorship is with adults who have just asked them those questions of just like, huh, why? And that goes so long because you want to help young people figure it out rather than telling them how it should be.
All right, so let's bring up the lights and see what questions you guys have.
And is there mics? Is that?
Yeah, there's someone with a mic back there. I can see in the muzzy. Okay.
Thank you. Wonderfully enlightening. Thanks very much. I especially connect with your emphasis on the underlying social structures that seem to be determining technologies. What about the underlying economic structures? Would you say more about those? Because they seem more covert to me, the investment, the marketing, the consumption, the profit that's involved, and how we can't seem to find out what's going on in that area.
You mean in particular with the companies and the commercial nature of all of these mechanisms?
Yeah, it looks free, kind of, but yeah. It makes us very suspicious about who's profiting and right. For what purpose.
You know, I've really struggled with this because, you know, as somebody who's extremely critical of contemporary American capitalism, I am not thrilled about how we've architected these systems at all. At the same time, I also think it's our fault, which is to say that for the last 30 years, we have systematically reduced young people's access to public life in a physical sense. And we've done it through a culture of fear. We've done it through anti-loitering laws and trespassing laws and curfew laws. We've done it to our response to latchkey kids and the overstructuring of kids' lives. We've done it through things that were well-intended, like school choice, that result in kids living at really large distances and being dependent on their parents to drive them. We have done it through the ways in which public spaces are deemed dangerous and therefore kids aren't allowed into them. And so the results, you know, and then there's a whole variety of other facets which I go into in the book. And as a result, these very commercial private enterprises have become a relief valve. The one place in which young people can gather with their friends, you know, in spite of all of the other structural conditions that we've set up there. And so I get really frustrated because we sit there and we're critical of the commercial aspects, and I'm certainly critical of them, but we're not creating meaningful and healthy public alternatives at all. Not just in terms of our digital systems, but in terms of our society as a whole. And so, you know, my feeling about it is that you don't like how commercial the internet's become, let your kid get on a bike, right? Let them actually roam, let them be allowed out. And not just your kid, but the entire community. And that's become really hard. In terms of the actual commercial nature of these sites and whatnot, you know, I'll resist the anti-capitalist rage. But you know, it's hard for me to deal with these, you know, individually, and you know, because they're so connected to a broader set of systems. It's not just about the major social technologies of the environment. But one of the things I will say is that this comes back to, again, my snarky comments on dying empires, which is that we've set up this notion that the technology sector is going to be our savior for the state of our economy, and we are not holding the sector accountable. And I don't mean it just from a legalistic, you know, a regulatory sense, but I mean it from a social sense. And so, you know, part of it is that nothing for the public social media, nothing is more going to be more effective than public rage, right? And, you know, you have these moments of public outrage where, you know, change happens, and I think that that's really important. There's a whole different beast for the private data brokering stuff, which is also at the back end of a lot of this. And I think that's where we start to see regulatory conversations become critical. I don't have faith in the United States or American citizens as a whole pushing back on it. I have a lot more faith of things happening in Europe, which are going to be messy and weird, and the right to forget frame is not actually functional. But it's a nice thought. And the question is, how do we actually get there? But I think it's important to not just isolate technology and say, technology, it's part of a broader system.
So explain the right to forget, since a lot of people won't know it.
So the European Union's equivalent of the Supreme Court, their high court, ruled that that Europeans have a right to forget, which has basically been deemed to be that any link to any content that is deemed problematic, or of the reputation of that individual, they can ask major search enterprises, namely Google, that's really the target of this, to remove that link. But the details are really murky. And so one of the first things that has come out is how often links to The Guardian, who've written some critical commentary about certain elected officials and other public figures, were asked to remove things. And the question is, how do you actually broker what is being removed and what's not? And it's this reminder that your reputation is not individually constructed. And this becomes a really challenging part about the right to forget, which is the assumption that you can remove it individually. But anybody who has dealt with massive reputation harm knows that it's all interconnected to other people, and that makes one of the most difficult things of how to navigate these issues, because it's so interconnected. And so again, it's a nice thing. It doesn't make sense technically, and that's a separate rant, but it's also, it's hard to figure out in light of really what we mean and who gets to be forgotten and who doesn't. And the other thing I'd say about it, it comes back to this idea we've all become public in different ways, so where's the boundary of when somebody is a public, figure and when they're not? Do they need to be elected? When they're elected, can they make fools of themselves and have that forgotten? Like, where are the boundaries? I live in New York. I can't constantly come back to Anthony Weiner, right? Like,
yes.
He's
some things we can't forget.
And then we do when he runs again and he does the same thing again, and it's like, oh man, really? I would like to not forget that.
Okay, someone out there has got a mic I can't see. Okay, yes.
I live in Glendale, and as you know, we have quite a group of malls out there, and when I have walked through some of the restaurants there or food courts, sometimes you'll see, and I'm sure we've all seen this, four teenagers sitting at a booth. They all are on their cell phones. They're not interacting with each other. And so my question is, to what degree do you think social media has actually interfered with personal interaction with the kids with each other, the kids with their parents? Because kids will go and they'll stay in the room for 6 hours. In fact, that's why my daughter, who was one of the first people on Facebook, said, "I'm getting off of it," after she was in Boston. "I'm getting off of it because I don't want my life to be like that." So my question is, I see as much interference as I do a lot of the positive factors.
Yep. These are the moments where I can give the response, "It's complicated." It's a really messy situation because it has a bunch of different tentacles that we need to account for. One is the variety of different practices that young people use their devices to do. You start to see people, including people that are not actually physically present, becomes really imperative for social status reasons and for dynamic reasons. I see a lot of young people who are in public spaces and they are with friends because that's safe, but they're often even doing their homework on their cell phones and people don't realize that. It's also a way in which they're tethered because their parents demand responses immediately, which is also a whole set of different factors. There's also ways in which they're doing activities where they're collectively sharing, where they're sitting there. There are a variety of different games that are actually all about sitting literally in shared Bluetooth or shared Wi-Fi and playing with one another. That is very social, but not out. What's been tricky to me is that I see a wide variety of practices in young people in terms of how much they're using these technologies, but I also see a wide variety in adults. and the ways in which adults have completely normalized the fact that this technology can be the center of your focus even when you've got family time. And I really struggle with it because a lot of kids are more frustrated at their parents about how their parents are using their devices at this point than they are necessarily about their peers and what they're seeing all around them. And I think it becomes like, you know, an example that I love to give is or that I see all the time is parents being like, okay, no phone at the dinner table, no phone, you know, after X hour because you're going to sleep, right? These are inevitable things, except I'm allowed to do it because clearly, you know, as an adult, my phone calls matter more than yours. And that creates this terrible dynamic. What I see from teenagers is that by and large, when they are allowed to be in social spaces truly unsurveilled, the technologies fade into the background to a certain degree. Not universally, and I actually think that this is something that we are seeing, you know, more and more of the technologies for inclusion that we're seeing them, you know, come into the social spaces, both adults and children. But by and large, they fade because they want to interact. That said, there are certain kinds of interactions that young people have been socialized in doing first and foremost, through mediated interactions. And so, you know, everything from flirting through, you know, different kinds of conflicts. So I remember, you know, sitting with a young person, a young boy, and he really liked this girl. And he spent 2 hours crafting the perfect 160-character message to look casual, right? And I was like, okay. You know, and he's sitting around with his friends all discussing what to say, right? And it's this moment, it's like, it's definitely flirtation. And kids have always stood around being like, what should I say to her? I'm not sure what to do. How do I navigate that, right? That's not, you know, necessarily new, but it's very technologically mediated. The same is true of conflict, which is like, how do I do it? And then literally, like, they'll write something out and they'll show it to all their friends. Was that the right thing to say? How do I respond now? And it becomes this collective process. And like that, both a blessing and a curse. So I think that the answer to your story is that it's not that everything is moving towards a bad sense, it's that it's all messy and that we have normalized it as adults, that we're seeing young people try to navigate this as teens, and it's definitely changing some of this, some for the better, some for the worse. It's not yet, you know, it's not like it's a straight line on this one.
And what I would add to that is I always think it's useful to do a permutation from old media to new media. So if you see a couple at a table at a Denny's reading the newspaper and talking to each other about the news they're reading, we pretty much normalize that as part of the everyday social interactions people have. If the same couple is sitting there with a cell phone in front of them and doing the exact same thing, we tend to pathologize that in terms of new media getting in the way of social interaction. If we see a couple photograph of a couple in bed both reading separate books, we take that as a normal way of relating to the universe. If they're sitting there with laptops and watching separate DVDs on their laptops, we would think something was really strange in that relationship. So I would like to propose we maintain not a double or triple standard where new technology is, but ask these questions, technology agnostic. You know, is it a good thing and a bad thing? And I'm not defending some of our social behavior, but I think we are seeing it differently depending on whether it's old media or new media at the center of those social interactions. All right, question? Yeah, who's got the mic?
Over here on the right.
Okay.
Hey, Dana. You mentioned something interesting earlier, and I think it was in relation to teens and moral crises. And you said that we're in a lull right now. So I was wondering if you could just dig a little deeper into that about how and why we might be in a lull, and then maybe say a little bit more about what you think the next thing will be.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that we're in a lull of moral panics, it's just that for once they're not on Stranger Danger, right? So that's why it feels like a lull for that topic. Right now, the anxiety du jour is a lot more about big data, and you know, whether it's, you know, talking about the different surveillance apparatus at a governmental level, or whether it's you know, Facebook's contagion study, you know, there's just this way in which that is this moment of like, oh my gosh, it's all about data. What will happen? These moments of uptick often come with new technologies that adults don't use. So right now, the dominant technologies that young people are using that adults don't use are not really being used in a way that's really truly about strangers. Most of it's really about friends. Whether we're talking about, you know, Snapchat through, you know, Instagram through, you know, even Twitter, which is actually better understood by parents. So you see this moment where that's not the central focus. So it's going to be about about the question of what the next thing is, that it really puts kids engaging, you know, en masse, rather than using the tools around them to do things with strangers. But it really, you know, when adults are involved on those platforms, they're less anxious about stranger danger. They're anxious about other things. You know, and the other cycles that we have around this is that we always have sexuality-related ones. You know, I snarked about Anthony Weiner, but he actually saved us from, you know, a multiple-year anxiety around teenagers and sexting because, you know, that was really starting to ramp up. And then when your elected officials are doing the things you're accusing kids of, you kind of shift your focus. So that shifted it. Now, the question is, what will the new sexuality? That will be another spike. And when those two collide, when it's about teen sexuality and strangers, it's ugly.
Okay, next question.
Hi there, good evening. First of all, I'd like to thank you for voicing, I guess, some of the struggles that, kids my age, you know, of that belong to minorities, such as, you know, queer communities and Latino communities are facing online. I come from more or less from an activist background. I did participate in that march you mentioned against the Sensenbrenner bill back in 2004, and I was part of the student organizing committee at Santa Monica College, where we used Facebook as a way to gather students and members of the community to fight against this two-tier education plan that the board of trustees try to pass. Mm-hmm. But my concern is, I've adopted this attitude where, I guess you could sum it up with the last line in Chinatown, you know, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. Mainly because I'm noticing that among my peers, we like to think of ourselves as champions of social cause or for change. And yet it seems that we keep falling into something that's called slacktivism. And I keep pointing out to my peers that you can't simply cause change just by posting up a picture or by posting up a status. And actually I've been ranting about that a while now since I've been noticing my friends who are pro-Palestinians, they've been posting hashtag I stand with Gaza, and I figure, well, that's not exactly helping the situation out there. So what would you recommend for someone like me who really is hands-on, but who's taken more of a cynical view, you know, just how do I, you know, inspire myself again to take up social change on the internet once again, and, you know, avoid the pitfalls that slacktivism presents itself.
Yeah. It's an important question. I think historically the things that are labeled as slacktivism were never visible, but were actually a really critical component of building the energy, building the background, creating the cultural context in which activists could do their activism. And now it's visible, so we blame that, and it's always going to be a larger scale of people that are going to try to voice their opinion on the topic and sort of dance around it. I think that that's really important to realize that in order to engage people in social change, you need a series of steps that are really critical. The first is that those who are activists in any way, they need to be safe, right? They need to be really secure in themselves, to be confident of their ability to handle whatever they're going to face, whether it's, you know, the mayor telling them that they're nobody, or whether it's a matter of the people in their community ostracizing them. And that becomes a really important factor in this. And there are a lot of young people who are not in a position of safety, such that we shouldn't expect them to engage radically from the get-go. That means that we should also think about how important it is to build a large network of people that they can turn to and be supportive of. And that's really a critical component, and it's one of the things that technology is often employed by, or that young people employ technology to do that, is to build this network, to give them the foundation with which they can make change, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe 5 years from now, but that's a critical step in this. The second set of things that we concern ourselves with are a set of skills, right? Do you have the mechanisms by which you can be an activist and you can make your voice heard, right? And this is where activists become really important in teaching all of the other communities or the wannabe activists what some of the, you know, the skills are that will make this really functional. whether it's social media skills, whether it's how to write an op-ed, whether it's how to actually resist or engage law enforcement in a productive way, all of these different mechanisms. And again, some people are at different stages about whether or not they're willing to do that. And then we wait for opportunities where change can be made really effectively. And that's where these things aren't arbitrary, right? So it's like you actually sit and watch and wait and you build the networks, you build the capacity, you really organize people in an effective way so that they can turn out and be supportive. And that means that there are people playing different roles in an activist, you know, dynamic. You know, for example, I am patently afraid of large crowds. It's one of my issues. We'll work on it. But what that meant was that, you know, in my teen years when we were doing a lot of activism, the last thing you could have possibly convinced me to do is march, right? Like, crowds, bad, bad, bad. And so I was the one who stood by the phone line back when you kind of needed that, who picked up all the calls when, people were arrested and negotiated all of the processes there. And the reason why it was really interesting for me is that I was often accused of not being a real activist, right? Because I wasn't the one getting arrested, because I wasn't getting over my fear of crowds. Except that I would argue that the role of being the person who answers the calls, you know, to deal with, you know, whatever arrest situation has a role there. And so that's why I say, as an activist, do what you do best and help the broader network find their position in this. And those positions are going to go from the lightweight posting a hashtag all the way through all of the different spectrum. Figure out how people, where people are at, help them understand where they're at, and remember that you're part of a collective cultural change, not just a set of action-oriented interventions. And that cultural change means you need to get that backing all the way from the low-level slacktivist type of activity, because it becomes a part of it.
Yeah, let me. As someone who just finished writing a book on attacking the slacktivist critique, let me add just a couple of things to what Dana just said here. Okay. The first would be that a lot of what we take for slacktivism is only seems so because we're looking at one moment in that process. So we can think about something like changing, putting an equality sign on your Facebook profile in support of gay marriage. People have labeled it the lowest minimal form of activism, the lowest risk form of activism, but you're a girl, someone in a school in Smyrna, Georgia, where I lived for 2 years, in the middle of it, and you put the picture up that's going to be seen by your youth minister, your mother-in-law, your grandmother, your teachers, your homophobic classmates. The Facebook picture is a small part of the set of social transactions you're going to have, and you better believe that person has taken a risk and announced, I'm the person you come to talk about that. The second is understanding this is part of a process which is going, you know, so what we know is that if you take that first step, you're very likely to take further steps into other kinds of activism. And what we're seeing is these kinds of online activisms are not displacing traditional forms of political engagement on the ground. They're actually increasing the likelihood that those behaviors are going to occur, often for kids who don't fit the usual suspect profile of kids who are going to be politically active. And the interesting thing is that the MacArthur Foundation sponsored a survey been oversampled for various minority populations, so we had a good sense of what minority youth are doing. The gap between voting from Latino youth and African-American youth, African-American youth vote more than any other group, Latino youth vote less than any other group, that's a 20-point spread. The percentage of the difference from online activity is a 5-point spread. So young people across races are more likely to come together politically online at the moment and to enter the political process online across diversity than would be true for traditional kinds of institutional participation like voting, petitioning, and so forth. So this is where the change is going to happen. This is where changes of attitude are happening. This is the gateway or scaffolding into political participation. And we better, as a society, take seriously the stuff that's being dismissed as slacktivism, because that's the first step toward engaging young people of all races in the political process.
I want to thank both of you for such an inspiring conversation, and for all of you for listening. Let's give a round of applause for... And they'll be joining you in the lobby.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.